SF Podcast.
About SF is a resource center for speculative literature, science fiction, and education. We are a joint project of the University of Kansas, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and the Science Fiction Research Association, with generous support from Tor Books, the Heinlein Prize Trust, and several individual donors. Please visit the About SF website at www.aboutsf.com. John Tibbetts, Associate Professor in the Department of Film and Media Studies at the University of Kansas, has donated recorded audio interviews with luminaries in the fields of science fiction and fantasy, including Ray Bradbury, Frederick Pohl, and Stephen King, among others, to the J. Wayne and Elsie M. Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction in Lawrence, Kansas. The interviews, gathered during the course of a lifetime of reading, collecting, and writing about science fiction, include conversations with Paul Anderson, Jack Williamson, L. Sprague de Camp, children's book author Chris Van Allsburg, and many more. At About SF, we are planning to present selections from John's donated interviews as part of our ongoing About SF audio podcast series. Episode 5 of the About SF podcast is a recording of a 1984 interview John conducted with science fiction writer Frederick Pohl. This seemed like an appropriate selection for the first of the podcast episodes using John Tibbetts' interviews, since the theme for the 2011 Campbell Conference is Alternating Currents, Frederick Pohl and Theodore Sturgeon. If you'd like to learn more about the Campbell Conference, or about Frederick Pohl or Theodore Sturgeon, please visit the Center for the Study of Science Fiction website. I would also like to note that Mr. Tibbetts' forthcoming book, The Gothic Imagination, Conversations on Fantasy, Horror, and Science Fiction in the Media, will be published by Palgrave Macmillan in October 2011, so everyone should check it out this fall. Without further ado, here is John's interview with Fred Pohl from 1984, in which Mr. Pohl discusses his collaborations with Cyril Cornbluth, the influence of the New Wave on his writing, and even his poetry. We're honored to have received such a wonderful donation from John Tibbetts, and we hope that this interview and many others may be of interest to fans and scholars alike.
Okay. Science fiction writer Fred Pohl is my guest now. Fred, it's a pleasure to meet you because many of us have read your works over the years, and it's always a bit of apprehension. What will the man be like? Will he be interesting? Will he be as much fun as his books? And listening to you talk all morning, you are a great talker, and you like to talk, I suspect, as much as you like to write.
I like to write better, but I cannot deny that I enjoy the sound of my own voice a whole lot.
We have such a limited amount of time. I'd like to do a quick survey, if I may, from your work with Sam Cornbluth up to the present-day sequel, if you will, to Space Merchants. Could you give us a little quick synopsis of your writing career and how far back that it takes you?
Well, it takes me back until I was 12 years old. I wrote the first story of my life in the 8th grade English class in public school number 9 in Brooklyn, when the teacher wasn't looking. A really remarkably rotten story called something about Atlantis.
Is it polite to ask what year that was?
1932. I was 12 years old. And I began trying to submit stories to magazines almost immediately. I think I was 13 or 14.
Now that we've poured some coffee. 1932, the age of 12, were you working from much experience in reading science fiction at that point?
Not a lot in reading science fiction. I don't remember a time when I couldn't read. I remember being able to read. I read all the boys' books and most of the girls' books and all of the other books that I could get my hands on. I discovered science fiction along about 1930, a magazine called Wonder Story. Someone left it at the house, and I began reading it. And then I read all I could find. Haunted the secondhand magazine stores to buy back issues of Amazing and Astounding had just begun at that time. And I found one or two other people in my school who had also read science fiction, and some of them had magazines I didn't have, so we swapped back and forth.
And not a kind of writing at that time regarded as being respectable, was it?
It was never regarded as respectable until quite recently. Well, recently in my terms, within the last 10 or 20 years, maybe.
And in fact, is there a part of you that almost regrets seeing it become respectable, if you know what I mean? A buccaneering instinct, maybe.
There's a part of me that thinks that its respectability has somehow damaged it. Leslie Fiedler says that science fiction lost its vulgarity around 1960 or so. And in a sense, he's right. It lost the feeling that there was no penalty for failure. because people took chances, did all sorts of things that I think many writers would be afraid to do now. I don't mean stylistic chances, but writing about things that were insane, really. There were a whole series of stories by a man named Joe W. Skidmore about an electron and a proton given animate form. Well, that's ridiculous. Nobody would write that now, and they weren't even very good stories. But it's that sort of vulgarity, that sort of recklessness that I think made science, one of the things that made science fiction interesting 40 years ago. And it does seem to me that a lot of writers have become self-conscious, having become accepted by critics and academics and so on. It's sort of like having somebody else stand behind you while you're writing a story, worrying, will he like this one as much as he liked the last one? Dare I try this thing which may fail catastrophically? And often saying, no, I do not dare. I'll play it safe this time.
In fact, writers and artists can rarely take that easy way out through life. A lot of us like to settle back into formulas, be it in life or in work. The writer, especially the science fiction writer, can't afford to do that.
But the science fiction writer has one characteristic, which is his saving grace. There was an attempt some years ago to make a group psychological profile of science fiction writers and contrast them with ordinary human beings. And they discovered that there was a characteristic of science fiction writers which was markedly different from the rest of the human race, and that was an equality called adventurous versus withdrawn cyclothymia, which translated means pigheadedness. I mean, science fiction writers are essentially the most stubborn and individualistic, obstinate people in the world. So this saves them from the worst penalties of this respectability.
Now, but anyway, do these descriptions apply to Frederick Pohl?
Certainly not.
Okay.
Although they have been applied to me from time to time. I did begin trying to write as soon as I was able to, as soon as I had a typewriter, as a matter of fact. I began submitting stories. I got the typewriter, I think, for my 12th birthday. And I was rejected many, many times over a period of several years, and I finally sold a poem I wrote when I was 15, was accepted when I was 16, published when I was 17, and paid for when I was 18. So somewhere in that area I became a professional writer.
Frederick Pohl, the poet, is not a designation I would have thought of immediately.
Well, I like fooling around with words, and poetry is one of the most demanding ways to do it. I still write a little poetry now and then. I have a slim sheaf in my file cabinet entitled Poems After 50, which someday I may publish. There are about a dozen of them.
While you're having some coffee, I'm going to remind everybody I'm talking to Frederick Pohl. We are on the campus of the University of Kansas John W. Campbell Awards, the Science Fiction Conference here under the auspices of James Gunn Center for Science Fiction Studies at the University of Kansas. Fred, have you been present at any of these gatherings that Jim has had over the years? I have to ask you that. Has this happened before?
Oh, a good many of them. University of Kansas for some years had a summer seminar for teachers of science fiction, and three writers each took a week of it, Ted Sturgeon, Gordon Dixon, and myself. So until last year, I was here every summer for a period of several years. I don't remember just how many. And I have taught courses here for university, or team taught, actually, or sat in on seminars of one kind or another. So this is, I've spent more time at this school than any other school in America.
We're going to dip back into your career now. When did you first meet Cyril Kornbluth and the noteworthy collaborative efforts that resulted? What was that all about, and how do you regard those years now? With a special fondness?
With a very special fondness. I'm really glad that you're asking me this, because I am just now on the point of trying to write a new introduction for a new collection of the short stories Cyril and I wrote. And as most of them have been published repeatedly, and I've written introductions before, I've run out of things to say. So if you can stimulate me to think of something I haven't said before, that'll be marvelous. There was an organization in New York called the Futurians. It was a club, science fiction fan club, different from most of them, only in degree, in that more of our members than usual wanted to be science fiction writers. There are few fan groups that don't contain would-be writers. But we had people like Isaac Asimov and Cyril and myself and James Blish and Judith Merrill and Damon Knight and Don Wolheim and a good many others who did go on to write science fiction. And Cyril turned up as a 14-year-old, very arrogant, nasty-mouthed, brilliant, funny interesting kid. He fit in very well. He was nasty-tempered and sardonic and all the other things that we sort of prided ourselves on being. And we all were trying to write. And in order to facilitate writing, we often collaborated, figuring we would fill in each other's deficiencies. Cyril and I began writing when I think I was 19 and he was 16. Short stories for the magazine. We wrote that.
Well, now, see, already I think of the novels as collaborative efforts, but not the short stories. Many of us maybe don't remember. Well, what, for example, short stories?
I should tell you, John, that one of the saving graces of my life is that for the first 10 years I published exclusively under pen names, and therefore I can lie about the stories. Some of the ones that Cyril and I wrote together have since been republished under our own names, but they were all on under pen names to begin with. But we wrote stories called things like Trouble in Time or Best Friend or Mars Tube, some of which were fairly good. At least they were fairly good by the standards of the time, or we thought so. But we really were too young and too wet behind the ears and too new at trying to learn what writing was all about to be very good. The way we worked was that I would think of an idea for a story and give Cyril an outline of the story, and he would write a rough draft, and I would rewrite it, and we would try to sell it. Shortly thereafter, I became the editor of a magazine called Astonishing Stories, so from then on we sold them all, because I bought them myself if nobody else would. But they were still not very good stories. Then the war came along. Cyril went in one direction, I went in another. And we got together again about 5 years after the war and began trying to write together again. I had begun a novel for Galaxy Magazine about the future of advertising. I'd written about a third of it, and the editor wanted it done really quickly, and I asked Cyril if he would collaborate with me on it. So we then finished it, and it was The Space Merchants, which has been around for a long time.
And in fact, advertising is one of the really consistent thematic either devices or subjects of many of your own works, too. So has that always been a predilection for you, mass marketing, advertising, that whole world?
It sort of went the other way, John. While I was in Italy during World War II, I had a lot of time on my hands, and I decided that I would write a novel, having nothing better to do with my time at the air base in Stornara, Italy, where my B-24 group was. And I thought I'd write a novel about New York City, because it was my home, and I was a little homesick for it. And I thought of what would be the most interesting thing to write about in that area, and I thought, let's write something about advertising. So I wrote an entire novel called For Some We Love. It's a quotation from Omar Khayyam, not really relevant to anything, which I finished. And a couple of years later, when the war was over, I pulled out and looked at and realized it was absolutely hopelessly bad since, among other things, I knew nothing about advertising. So I applied for a job with an advertising agency.
Because I knew there was experience in there someplace. Okay.
I spent about 3 years writing advertising copy for one outfit or another, first for an agency and then for a publishing company. Realized the novel was not worth thinking about anymore and decided to start a science fiction novel about it, which is how The Space Merchants began.
And might I interject at this point that extrapolating the wonders of products, is that necessarily so very different from the wonders in science fiction? If you have a talent for one, you might have a talent at the other, maybe.
Well, see, all fiction is lying, but advertising is pernicious lying.
Very good. Now, when did you know that Space Merchants was... we regard it as a classic. How long does it take a science fiction book to become a classic? At the time that it came out? Well, were there any inklings like that?
When it came out in magazine form, it was pretty popular, but there's no real way to measure that except by letters from readers or the comments of friends. When it appeared in book form, before it appeared in book form, I submitted it to every publishing company in America that had a science fiction list, and they all turned it down, some of them very harshly. A good friend of mine, I knew all these people well, all the editors, and one of them, being a good friend of mine, took me aside and said, Fred, I really have to tell you, there's some interesting ideas in here, but it's not of professional quality. You need to find some skilled professional writer to pull it together for you. which was sort of a crushing thing to hear. But I didn't necessarily believe him, so I kept on offering it around until we never found a professional writer to pull it together, but we found an amateur publisher who didn't need that. Ian Ballantyne had just started Ballantyne Books. He read it. He didn't know that it was not a professional quality, so he published it.
I love that.
And it began getting very good reviews from all sorts of places. And about then is when Cyril and I began to think that we really had done something a little better than we had hoped for.
Because to my mind, it was one of the first times that science fiction had really taken on a Madison Avenue-type world, and we saw that the two really could go together. It didn't have to be rocket jockeys across the spaceways at all.
Well, that's, I think, why it was turned down by all the science fiction editors. It had no space pirates in it, not even one. And they just could not reconcile that with what they thought was science fiction. But then Cyril and I wrote wrote three other science fiction novels and three novels which were not science fiction together. And would probably still be doing it now, except that he died very suddenly and untimely at the age of 34, I think it was, of a heart attack. And therefore I was cast on my own resources and had to write by myself.
Well, we think of so many collaborative teams working, and of course Fletcher Pratt and L. Sprague de Camp is one, and you and Kornbluth are another. What are some of the other great science fiction teams that you have known of over the years? Purnell and Niven's, I guess, recently.
Purnell and Niven, I think, are the class of the field right now. Jack Williamson and I have written a number of books together, which I'm fairly well pleased with. One of the good things about it is that Jack and I write in ways which are quite dissimilar, so there's a conflict or a synergy between us. It's not that we're doing the thing that we do independently. We do something different when we write together. But there have been a lot of well-known collaborative teams, beginning with people like Earl and Otto Binder, who wrote under the name of E. Ando Binder in the 30s,
yes.
20s, and I guess just in the 30s.
And Kuttner and Moore.
Kuttner and Moore, and many others.
I have to ask you, did you know Henry Kuttner? I assume you did.
Oh, yes.
Probably, well, all of us have heroes, I suppose, in this field, but he certainly is one of mine.
I admired Kuttner immensely. He was a fine writer. He was a very shy person, so I didn't know him really well. I knew him over a period of 10 or 15 years, but he was reclusive, and he lived usually in California, and I hardly ever left New York at that time, so I only saw him occasionally.
But something happened with him that apparently happened with you. The beginnings in a more traditional kind of science fiction, and then books like Fury started showing up, and those memorable short stories, and similarly in your own work. Was there a sensibility operating somewhere in the mid to late 40s where a lot of science fiction writers were reacting in similar ways and beginning to change the form?
Well, I don't think that it was in, I don't know what was happening in Henry Kuttner's mind, but I just got tired of doing the same thing and wanted to do something different. Also, a little later than the 40s, along about 1960 or maybe a little earlier, there was a thing in science fiction called the New Wave, which was a movement to free science fiction of its shackles as a pulp literature with a plot and a hero and a heroine and adventure and so on. People like Brian Aldiss said things like, nobody should write about stupid old Jupiter anymore. I wanted to write about the inner space, a science fiction of the interior, which movement really sort of, the wave hit against the rocks and disappeared into froth and doesn't exist anymore. But because of the example of these people, a lot of writers who had been around for some time, like myself, began to realize slowly that there were other ways to write than in the traditional plot formula of a problem solved by the hero with great resource and winding up with a happy ending. And New Wave was a great liberating force for me.
All of which points to the fact that since Space Merchants on up to the present, you have continued to grow and develop. What is the wildest thing that you have ever tried in a book? Maybe it didn't work, maybe it didn't come off, but in your own mind you were proud of the experiment.
The wildest thing I've ever tried I haven't published or even quite finished yet. It's a... It's what may be the fourth volume of the series that began with Gateway. And it's an attempt to write from a point of view that I can't describe. It's It's a human being who has the capacities of a large mainframe computer doing serving several dozen terminals simultaneously. I'm trying to write it from his point of view. And I'm not sure that's working. There are a lot of things that I've done that I'm pleased to have done. In Gateway, for example, which is a novel of mine that I like best, there was an attempt to... What I tried to do was to show the world I was writing about as it could have been seen by the hero himself, by any character in it, without directing the reader's attention to specific things. So I filled the book with what I called sidebars, classified advertisements or pamphlets or letters or showing everything that was going on, trying to give a total picture of what that world was like. And I think it worked pretty well. I don't know that anybody has ever done quite that before. John Dos Passos did something like it in the 1919 trilogy, and John Brunner did the same as Dos Passos in Stand on Zanzibar. I don't think anybody's ever done it in the way that I did there.
In the meantime, the science fiction short story seems to be, at least in my mind, a somewhat neglected form, and you and Clifford Simak are two writers that have always had the wonderful ability to really take the reader into a good yarn. And I'm wondering, among your short story product, what you could cite as being something that's a favorite son of yours. Again, a risk, maybe.
Well, I think the story that I like best, the one that I'm willing to have engraved on my tombstone, is called Day Million. And it was, I think, a risky story. I was trying to write about human beings in terms of what their life was like under conditions so unlike our own that there's almost no point of resemblance. It's 1,000 years in the future. And it was an interesting story to write. I wrote it very rapidly. If I'd hesitated and thought about it, I might never have written it at all. And when it was done, I was really pleased with it, and I still am.
On the whole, is this really a crazy way to make a living?
Writing is a crazy way to make a living. In fact, it's a very poor way to make a living. It's said of writing that it's a bad way to make a living, but one of the better ways to get rich, and that's true. There is no middle ground. You either starve or you do quite well.
In the meantime, you've been writing with your son. Is it almost like a movie star sometimes wanting to discourage a child or son from getting into the same profession? Was it like that here?
No, I would love it if he got into the same profession, but his interest was in film rather than in writing. Actually, what his interest is in writing for film or directing film. What he would really like to be is Stanley Kubrick, but Kubrick presently occupies that job and shows no sign of giving it up. But his degree was in film, and he knew a great deal about the technical aspects that I did not. And, of course, being my son and being exposed to all the science fiction writers that we knew, he knew a great deal about science fiction from several points of view, as a reader, as a watcher of films, and as somebody who'd grown up with Uncle Lester Del Rey around the house.
Uncle Lester. Meantime, our time is growing short. Just one last question. Update Space Merchants for us, because if we've not already found it in hardback, we'll shortly be finding it in paperback. What is it called, and how have you extended that world?
The sequel is called The Merchant's War. It is written 30 years after the original, and it takes place 30 years after the time of the original. It begins on the planet Venus, and some people come back from Venus to experience what Earth is like 30 years later. And I enjoyed writing it. While I was writing it, I was traveling in China, in the western reaches at around the Gobi Desert, and therefore there is a sequence in it which takes place on the Gobi Desert. It occurred to me at the time that what I was seeing there was just ideal for what I wanted to do in the novel. So.
There must have been pressures upon you to do a sequel, if that's the word, long since, huh?
Yeah, there have been pressures on enough, but I resisted them for 30 years. And then about two years ago now, I suddenly thought, yes, maybe I will try it, and it went very quickly.
Did you ever find yourself testing it in terms of what would Cyril think? Would he have approved, etc.?
All the time. The reviews have said that it is a novel of the 50s, not of the 80s, which is not kindly meant by the reviewers, but which is in fact what I was trying to do. I wanted to write it as though Cyril and I had written it at that time. And I think it comes out pretty much that way.
Frederick Pohl, that 12-year-old reading wonder stories, I suspect that same individual exists today.
Oh, yes, I still read. I don't read Wonder Stories because it's gone, but I
still,
do read some.
Still 12 years old?
Still 12 years old inside me. Oh, sure. Sense of wonder, what they say, the sense of the miraculous, the exciting, the transcendental. That's what I read science fiction for.
And as I learned this morning, still argumentative.
Oh, not me. I deny that furiously.
Thank you very much.
This concludes our broadcast. Thank you for listening to the About SF podcast. Please visit us at www.aboutsf.com.